I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Being released from prison is a second chance at life, but it's not always easy to make the most of it. Turns out, living on the other side of the bars doesn't necessarily equate to freedom. Today, how a major career change helped one man see the inner workings of a flawed justice system. It also taught him lessons about the unexpected stress of the job and why reform won't be easy to come by. Then, a proposed budget cut to certain arts programs is pushing waves through Kansas City. So much so, the mayor has walked back some of the proposed reductions. So what programs made the cut, and what will it mean for the city's art scene? We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Jason Hardy was selling watches at JCPenney and thinking that what he wanted to do was make a difference in the world. So he made a big career change and became a parole officer in New Orleans, where he thought he could have a big impact in a short amount of time. What he found instead was long hours, low pay, and an impossible caseload of 220 people. That's four times the recommended amount. The needs were far greater than he could ever meet, and after a few years, he was off to the FBI. Jason Hardy has written about his experience in the world of parole and second chances in a new book, The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. He's a former high school English teacher. Jason, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And why did you think you could make such a big difference as a parole and probation officer?
Well, I think the first idea I had in my head was that the criminal justice system just was in need of fresh blood, for lack of a better way of putting it. I'd read The New Jim Crow and a lot of the other kind of books that were coming out. This was late 2011, early 2012, that were just talking about kind of new ways to think about criminal justice and doing some kind of deeper dives into kind of how we'd gotten into the fix we were in, where we had over 2 million people in prison. And one of the ideas that was out there was just that, you know, the people who were in there had been doing it too long. They were burned out. And, you know, maybe a fresh set of eyes, kind of some new energy could come in and maybe make a difference. And with probation and parole, because you sort of were in charge of whether or not people went back to jail, it just seemed like kind of the ideal job to sort of be pushing against that tide.
How much impact, as you look back on it now, do you think you wound up having?
Candidly, not a whole lot.
Wow. Yeah.
Having said that,
that was my sense. Yeah.
I think that there were times when I was able to contribute in a way that was meaningful, but unfortunately, a lot of it was out of my hands. Our resources were extremely limited, and more often than not, the job came down to the choice of whether or not to send someone back to jail. And there were far too many times when we could really offer someone a viable alternative to that outcome.
You know, still, you wound up thinking that, you know, this is where you can make the most difference in the criminal justice system, the whole probation, parole sort of arena. Why? What made you go to that place?
Well, for one thing, the size of it, it comprises about 4.5 million people. So it's this massive footprint. It's by far the largest outcome that you get in the criminal justice system. Far more people are put on some form of supervised release than are actually sent to prison. So, And again, the idea behind it is that you're not putting them in jail because there's hope that a better outcome could work. And so what I saw was that the framework was there. You know, the mindset was right that we don't have to put everybody in jail. We can help a lot of people by getting them resources, by getting them treatment, by getting them employment. But there wasn't really any follow through. When it came down to, you know, you get someone in your office who kind of wants the help and is ready to make the change, we really didn't have anything to offer them. And that was kind of the recurring theme over and over again, was that even in those rare cases where we really felt like we could get through to someone and that person was ready to make a change, we really couldn't give them the tools they needed to do it.
What would you have needed to make just what you described happen?
I think the thing we needed the most with regard to drug addiction, which was probably the biggest issue that we faced, was just kind of conventional medical care. We didn't have access to a clinical detox. There was one free detox in the city, but it only had the capacity for about 4 or 5 people. Mm. And so the only way that you could get someone in there was to call ahead with, you know, 2 or 3 weeks' notice, which anyone who's worked with people suffering from addiction can tell you, most addicts are not going to give you 2 to 3
right.
weeks notice.
Right.
You know, when they're ready to get clean, you have to be able to act then. So what that meant was that if people wanted to get clean, the only thing we could really do for them was put them in jail, and they could get some form of medical detox inside the jail. So we would actually have people who were desperate enough that they would come to us and say, hey, I need you to lock me up, because if you don't, I'm going to go out and overdose.
What do you make of that, the idea that the jail became the place to detox, if you will, and as a more preferable route than doing it the more conventional way through a medical detox outside?
I think we used the jail because it was what we knew. Mm-hmm. You know, it was sort of the end result of 25, 30 years of trying to solve every social problem with incarceration. The thing that is so mind-boggling about it is that pretty much every study will tell you incarceration is always the most expensive fix to a problem. And certainly in some cases, I think it's the only way. But I think in the majority, there are other things that you can do that are better for the individual that you're trying to rehabilitate and better for society at large.
Such as?
And certainly getting somebody detoxed is something that you can do far less expensively in some kind of clinical setting than you can just by sticking them in jail for a week.
What else did you hear about the experience in jail or prison that made you shake your head?
Well, at that time, the parish jail in New Orleans, Orleans Parish Prison, was under a federal consent decree, and the inmate death rate was something like 4 times the national average. So even by the standards of jails, it wasn't a place that people wanted to be. And so the fact that people were willing to go there to get detox told you just how desperate the situation was. I will say the Department of Corrections in Louisiana has actually come a long way. There are a lot of programs there that are frankly cutting edge, including a reentry program where people who are doing 10 years on, you know, fairly serious offenses are able to get out in 2 if they learn a trade in the prison. And they're not just learning the trade, they're actually getting plugged into jobs when they get out. So that's one program that I'm really excited about. A lot of what I'm talking about here sounds doom and gloom, but there are actually some good things happening now. I see a lot of positive momentum in what's going on in prison, but having said that, you know, we still have a long way to go, I think.
I mean, you wouldn't necessarily point to Louisiana as being a cutting edge type of place.
No, not normally, but I think that kind of in our desperation, we've sort of turned a couple of corners. And again, I don't want to speak too generally because a lot of the programs I'm talking about are still kind of in fledgling phases. But sometimes, you know, when you've kind of bottomed out, that's when you get creative. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that throughout the criminal justice system, that as folks have become more aware of how widely we're using prison and how many people we might be able to rehabilitate in a way that's more humane and more cost effective, that's where you really kind of get to see some new ideas. And a lot of the new thinking out there right now is very outside the box and stuff that, frankly, would have seemed crazy 20 years ago.
What's the biggest predictor of whether an offender is going to be successful on probation or parole as you look back on it, Jason?
I would say employment is far and away the number one thing.
If you have a job when you're ready to get one.
Gainful employment where that mm-hmm. person essentially has something to lose, they have something to work for, something to kind of put their energy toward, that's going to be the best inducement not to go back to prison. That assumes that the person is capable of maintaining full-time employment. A significant number of people that came to us, at least in New Orleans, which granted is a very poor town, but you know, a lot of folks with mental health issues, a lot of folks suffering from addiction. So I would say getting mental health and addiction squared away is number one, if you have those issues. But across the board, having some way to kind of maintain an income, get a stable life, and housing really goes hand in hand with that. And there's sort of this chicken and the egg problem with, can you actually get a job without housing? Can you get housing without a job? But it's some of it is almost common sense. You know, if you think about what the average person needs, they need to be able to put food on the table. They need to have shelter at the end of the day, and they need to have work that's meaningful to them.
So a job, getting mental health and addiction squared away, housing, this the basics here, right?
Yes. And the kind of recurring theme is that a lot of these are things that, if they're taken care of in kind of a public health way, they don't have to become criminal justice matters. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the people who are coming through our doors at probation and parole are people who've gotten in trouble with the law. But if probation and parole work the way that they should, the overwhelming majority of these folks become kind of receivers of services that allow them to rehabilitate their lives, to kind of become taxpayers, become civilians. you know, and then you're left with a small minority that end up going back to prison. That's the system as it should work.
You know, one of the big issues here, it seems to me, is sort of lack of political will to do what you just described. You know, get offenders a job, mental health services, addiction services, housing. I mean, you know, politicians, there's no upside for them to push for those kinds of programs.
I think it comes down to mindset. I've thought about this a lot, and I'm as guilty of this as the next person. You know, when you think about public safety, you kind of feel like you should spare no expense, right? It's like national defense. Like, you know, we'll pay whatever we got to pay to keep ourselves safe. When it comes to something like, you know, helping people out with housing or helping people get, you know, certified to do some kind of a job, I think it feels, frankly, more like welfare, more like a social service. And that's something that can be a lot touchier, you know, because certainly people have varying opinions on that. But I think the trick with probation and parole is to try to keep everything under the same umbrella and to view all these forms of rehabilitation as investments in public safety. And you know, these aren't simply handouts. These are ways that we can help people to get their lives back on track instead of costing taxpayer money to become tax contributors and to commit fewer crimes. You know, yeah. So I think it's not a huge leap to get there, but I think it really comes down to viewing these things as public safety matters and not simply as, you know, some sort of social welfare.
Jason Hardy is my guest. He's the author of a new book, The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison, getting lots of strong reviews. Tell us about someone you've helped, Jason, during your time and maybe somebody you let down.
Sure. Well, I have more in the latter category,
yes,
unfortunately, but people that we helped, usually we would help them by getting creative. And there's one story that I talk about in the book, a guy named Kendrick, who had a really traumatic life, for lack of a better way of putting it. He was someone who lived with his mother. She was abusive to him, but she had been abused by various boyfriends, by her own parents. Kendrick's father was kind of rarely around. He was a neighborhood drug dealer who was shot dead in front of Kendrick when Kendrick was 11 or 12. So just a ton of trauma that this person dealt with when he was young.
Mm-hmm.
He dropped out of school in eighth grade, and he kind of had been cycling in and out of the Department of Corrections throughout his 20s and 30s. So when I got him, he was maybe mid 30s, and he really was acutely aware that you know, he had a mental health issue that he needed help with, and he had these kind of attacks that he would call clicking out. And essentially what he meant is he would just lose his cool and start assaulting people. You know, mm-hmm. And he knew that it wasn't the right thing to do, but he just didn't have the ability to control it. And so we tried to get him some kind of mental health care through, you know, this sort of what you'd think of the typical means, you know, through Medicaid, but we weren't able to kind of manage the paperwork on that. You know, to stay in the good graces of Medicaid, you've got to really be able to, you know, show up on time for appointments, get your paperwork in, and that was kind of beyond him. He was homeless and living on the streets. And what we ultimately determined was that really the only way that we could get him mental health care was to put him back in jail for 90 days. The only real public option was to put him back in a prison in Baton Rouge that was outfitted with a couple of psychiatrists. And the mm-hmm. idea was that if we could get him up there and he could get a diagnosis, then he would have the paperwork that he needed to potentially get some treatment kind of here on the street. And so it was this kind of mind bender of a moment where, you know, I've come in there trying to keep people out of jail, and the only solution that I can come up for this person's problem is to actually put him back in. But it got us what we needed. You know, mm-hmm. he came out and he had the paperwork he needed, and we were able to apply for services from him after that.
How about someone you let down?
Sure. Well, I think the biggest letdown that we saw over and over again were people whose addiction was just more than they or we could overcome. I speak about one guy in the book, Travis, who was a guy who was in his early 20s. He didn't have a very long record. And Travis was someone who actually got more opportunity than most. He was recovering from a heroin addiction, and he had a girlfriend who had a relative who worked for an oil company and was able to get him a job on an oil rig, which, you know, in this part of the country, those are really good paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And they can lead to, you know, a six-figure income if you can stick it out. But despite good fortune, you know, the addiction just continued to get the better of him. And, you know, it almost seemed like whether he was kind of going through a great period in life or a low period in life, heroin would always take the wheel at some point. And so we went through kind of every form of programming that we knew how to try. You know, we tried going hard on him, going easy on him, and nothing worked. And ultimately, he ended up going back to jail on my recommendation, and simply because I felt that if I didn't send him back, he was going to die of an overdose. And kind of as I said with Kendrick, it was one of these moments where, again, I'd come aboard trying to keep people out of jail, and here I am putting somebody back in because it seemed like the only way to save his life.
Jason Hardy's my guest. His book, The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, you went into this work with this sort of idealistic sense that, boy, you were going to keep people out of prison. Why was that sort of your goal going in? What had driven you to that place? Because you're describing something.
I think, honestly, just the reading that I'd done about kind of how the system worked, and it just seemed very clear to me that there were better ways to deal with a lot of the problems that folks who were coming through the system were dealing with. And, you know, I wasn't coming in there saying, hey, nobody should be locked up or you know, everybody here is wrongfully accused. But I felt like there was a significant number of people who could be helped another way. And frankly, and again, maybe this was my own bias, but I really felt like most of the people I was gonna encounter on the job were gonna be people who didn't really care. And I thought that even though I didn't have, you know, the training or the expertise, just the fact that I was willing to come in there and work hard and have compassion for people, I kind of thought that was unique. And I was pleasantly surprised when I found that in fact almost everyone I worked with really cared and really wanted to make this system work. And you know, we're all brutally aware that they were working in a very flawed system, but still were determined to try to get good outcomes for people if they could.
What does a parole officer do?
Well, the kind of old go-by is that you wear two hats, and you know, one of them is a law enforcement hat where, you know, if the person is presenting a threat to public safety, and that can mean a lot of things. You could go to his house and, you know, he might have a gun on the counter. Then you've got to be the police. You know, you got to put the handcuffs on, confiscate the gun, take the ride to jail. And the other hat is kind of closer to being a social worker, where your job is to try to rehabilitate this person and whatever that means. And again, it could be mental health. It could be substance use. It could be simply helping the person get some kind of gainful employment. But I think that's kind of the tension at the heart of the job, is that you're trying to do two things that at times can almost seem to be in opposition. But the best officers kind of can somehow walk that line, where they can both be an authority figure when they need to, but sort of also convey that the first line of defense is kind of the social services, and that ideally, if this thing goes the way it's supposed to, the kind of cop side never has to come out.
Mm-hmm. You know, people get probation and parole confused. What is the difference?
It really depends where you are. Practically, at least in Louisiana, there's not much difference. The rules are essentially the same. I guess the biggest kind of day-to-day difference would be that if there's a major violation that needs to be dealt with, probation is generally run through a court system where the individual would be brought before a judge, mm-hmm. and parole is run by a parole board. But again, the terminology can kind of be misleading. So the federal system, for example, doesn't have parole anymore. They have this thing called supervised release. They have kind of pretrial release. So there's a lot of different terms, but in general, you're talking about the same thing. And mm-hmm. it's a system where, you know, folks are visited at home by an officer whose job it is to kind of help them get their lives back on track.
You know, you write in here that getting to know the people in your caseload was essential to having any sort of impact on them. How well did you get to know the people assigned to you? Because, as I mentioned, you had this huge caseload of 220 individuals. That's four times the recommended amount.
Yes, I would say that most of them I could barely pick out of a lineup. So out of 220, most of my time was spent on between 40 and 50 who, through some combination of my own sense of it and kind of this internal risk assessment that our department used, those were the people that I was spending most of my time on. And, mm-hmm. you know, risk assessments are this kind of hot topic in criminal justice now. And, you know, how reliable are they? Do they have inherent bias? On some level, though, I think at the very least, the ones that we use could tell you how long this person had been in the system, You know, what his medical issues were, what his socioeconomic status was. So it was at least a starting point, you know. And if you have to choose between spending your time on someone who has, you know, a history of violent behavior, who's living on the streets, whose mental health needs have not gone met, you know, it seems like that person's a better use of your time than someone where this is their first offense, mm-hmm. and, you know, their needs are not as acute, and you generally feel like, hey, this person is probably going to be okay.
Right.
Having said that, you can also make the argument that the folks who are kind of closer to kind of getting their lives back on track, those might be the ones where you can see the biggest benefit. But I can say that in my experience, generally, it was the top quartile were the ones that got most of the attention. Everybody else, we more or less ignored.
Let's go to some phone calls here as we talk about the whole world of probation and parole with Jason Hardy. Again, his book, The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. Let's go to Aaron from Lenexa. Aaron, good morning. You there, Aaron? Okay, let's go to Carl from St. Joseph. Carl, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you very much. I ran a Missouri probation and parole office in Chillicothe for 10 years. Prior to working for probation and parole, I was a state trooper. But I can tell you everything this guy is telling you is true. It's underfunded. We could be helping so many more people and make such a bigger impact on crime in Missouri if we properly ran and funded probation and parole.
And Jason, that's one of the reasons you wrote this book, right?
Yes, sir. I thank the caller for chiming in. And I will say that I've been fortunate to hear from a lot of POs across the country who have kind of reached out and said, hey, I know some of the stuff you talked about seemed like it was unique to New Orleans, but this is going on everywhere that, you know, we see potential in people. We see people we want to help, and we just don't have the resources to do it. And I think that's unfortunately pretty close to a universal truth.
A typical day for you was what?
Well, most of our time was spent in what we call the field, which just means outside the office. Most of the time you're driving around the city, and you're knocking on doors and you're trying to see people in their environment. If the person is fortunate enough to have a job, you might go to the job site and visit him there. You also spend some time in court. Not always on major issues, but folks on probation and parole in New Orleans tend to have issues that range from, you know, traffic court, misdemeanor court. So you might check in on what's going on there. But the main thing that you're trying to do is get as much information as you can about this individual to try to figure out how best to rehabilitate them. And it also can help you a lot if the person gets back in trouble to sort of make a case to a judge or a parole board about what the right response might be.
Right.
You know, we had many cases where things seemed to be going well, and then the person got in trouble, and the judge had to decide whether or not that person was going to go to jail or get some sanction somewhere in the middle. And a good report from an officer could maybe sway the judge to be lenient. There were also times when I would tell the judge, hey, look, I'm seeing a lot of warning signs with this guy. I think that, you know, if he was driving around in the car with a gun, that's something that we should take pretty seriously. So it could go either way. But the idea is pretty simple. You know, the more information you have, the more you can help the decision makers come to some kind of a just decision about what to do with somebody.
Did the judges listen to you?
Yes. I really was fortunate to have excellent judges I worked with here in New Orleans. Like everybody in the criminal justice system in New Orleans, they were, you know, overworked, underpaid, the whole gamut. But they really tried to listen to probation and parole officers because they understood that even as strapped as we were, we had more information than anybody else, you know, because we'd been out to the houses, we'd spent time in conversation with the folks on our caseload. And so, you know, the thing I think everybody wants in the criminal justice system is more time and more information. Mm-hmm. You're always trying to get to that informed judgment about a person. And so because we had more information than other people, they were eager to hear from us. And that didn't mean that they always agreed. You know, some judges just ideologically were a lot more lenient. Some were ideologically a little tougher. But if nothing else, we could bring something to the table that they couldn't get just from reading a police report or listening to a defense attorney or a prosecutor kind of give their side of the story.
John from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on with Jason Hardy. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello. Thank you for taking my call, Jason and Steve. Well, Jason, I think what you're doing out there is fantastic. I myself am a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. I have 18 months and 10 days.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And in the fall, I am pursuing a mental health counseling degree, a master's. And I was wondering, my question is, what steps or what channels are there to get out in the field to get some hours and do some of the things like you are doing here in Kansas City, if you have that info?
I can't speak to Kansas City because I'm in Louisiana, and I will tell you that, you know, the jurisdictions vary a whole lot. You might just try kind of reaching out to your local office. I can tell you one thing I'm really excited about that's going on here is that we have some folks who are actually currently on probation and parole who are kind of acting as social services conduits at the probation and parole office here now. So one thing that I think we really need more of is people who've both been in the system and people who just have dealt with substance use and addiction. And I think that, you know, you can bring a perspective that some people who are currently working in the system can't. Hmm. So honestly, the best advice I could give you might be just to call them up and see if you could either ride along or maybe hang out in the office for a while. Again, it really depends on the jurisdiction, how much they can kind of allow folks to come in and do that kind of stuff. But I can almost assure you, if you're interested and want to help, they need the help. And if that ends up helping you as well, I think that'd be a win for everybody.
How stressful was the work?
Extremely. I think that over time, some people get better at not taking it home with them. I don't think I was really in that number. In fact, ultimately, the reason I walked away was I felt like I was really struggling to process it and to not kind of take my frustrations out on the folks I was dealing with. You know, there were days when I felt like I didn't have enough patience. I felt like I was just frustrated by how little I could do. Again, there are some people who with time and experience, they can kind of walk out of there at five and say, hey, I did my best. I'm going to forget about this till tomorrow and try again. But, you know, you see, I had people die of overdoses on my caseload. I had people who were murdered, people who committed murders. It's heavy stuff, you know, and even if you know that you're not solely responsible for what happens, you know, you still take it to heart. You know, you still always ask yourself, was there more I could have done? Maybe just my tone of voice the last time we met, you know, might have changed the dynamic. So I found that to be a really hard thing to turn off.
How did you manage to go from high school English teacher to J.C. Penney watch salesman to New Orleans parole officer?
I don't know. It was a downward spiral, I guess. I tried to teach for a couple of years. I just wasn't any good at it. It's a vocation. Some people have it. Some people don't. And you know, after 3 years, I just said, I'm not right for this job. And I went to grad school, and then I knocked around in the service industry for a while. And I think I just always kind of wanted to do something in the public service arena, but I just didn't really know what. And, you know, when I was kind of trying to reboot at 29, it happened to be in a time when there was a lot of literature out there about the criminal justice system. And it just looked like kind of a fabric of American culture that, you know, if you wanted to get involved and you wanted to make a change, this was kind of the place to do it.
Right. Let's go back to some calls. Richard from Overland Park. Richard, good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was interested in the in your ability to control recidivism in terms of, are you able to see it coming? The reason I ask is I was an employer of a gentleman who was on parole, and I really wanted to give him a chance, and he did a really good job, and he was required, the parole officer was required to contact me and ask questions. He spoke to me every couple of weeks. Everything was great. And the day, literally the day he got off parole, he went and purchased some drugs and got arrested. And the parole officer the entire time was like, he's a great con artist, he'll have you believing with all of your heart, and then he'll break your heart. And I just wanted to find out your opinion of addressing addiction as opposed to incarceration. I know that's a very broad topic, but I'll take it off the air. Thank you so much.
I bet you've heard stories like that before, Jason.
Yes, I have been con many times. First of all, let me say that what the caller just said, a business owner employing someone who is in this system, That is absolutely the best possible service that anyone can provide, and I can't say that enough. If you're out there wondering what you can do to help, if you can give employment even on a probationary basis to someone who's in this system, that is going to be the best way to help that person get back on his feet. Having said that, obviously the caller's experience in this case was that maybe this person was not fully rehabilitated. I will say, though, you know, if what ended up happening was he went out and purchased drugs, it's possible that he wasn't conning anybody. It's possible that he really felt like he was doing great. He really felt like he turned a corner and the addiction just came back and bit him. And that's one of the really frustrating things about trying to help people who suffer from addiction, is that their mind can be right, everything can be going great, and then they can just lose that battle. And the guy I mentioned earlier, Travis, it was a similar situation where he had this great kind of opportunity mm-hmm. of a lifetime. And it was almost like, you always hear about addiction getting you when you're down, but it can get you when you're successful too. So mm-hmm. I would urge the caller, you know, don't judge every probationer and parolee by that experience. You know, it's really a wonderful thing to do to give that person a job. And honestly, even the fact that he only had the job for a short time, that might have embedded somewhere, and maybe, you know, a year from now when he gets himself clean again, he'll get back to work and it'll turn out differently next time.
That's Jason Hardy again. His new book, The Second Chance Club: Hardship and Hope After Prison. It's a look into a world very few of us ever get a good look at. Jason, thanks for doing the book. Thanks for taking some time with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. After a short break, when we come back, we'll talk about Mayor Quentin Lucas reversing his cuts to arts programs and what that means for the arts community in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, as police and city leaders struggle to get crime under control, one group is going door to door and asking neighbors, why are we so angry? It's part of a new anti-violence project from KC Mothers in Charge. We'll learn about it on Thursday here on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas is walking back some of the big cuts he originally proposed to city arts programs. The Kansas City Film Commission originally was slated for a $175,000 cut, but the mayor restored that money plus another $25,000. The mayor also said he will now provide $75,000 for the Arts Tech Teens in Transition program, which provides arts programming, conflict resolution, and career readiness to teens. How is the arts community feeling about all this? And what about the future for the Office of Creative and Cultural Services that's eliminated under the mayor's proposal? Joining us now is Brandon Harrelson. He's the Communications Manager for Engagement and Public Policy for Arts KC. Brandon, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning.
So how did the arts community originally receive the mayor's original proposed budget that contained all these cuts to the arts? How did that go over?
We got it the same day that, the public saw it. We saw it that day. And, our initial reaction was to try to curb what we could and to figure out with our community partners what we could do to mitigate the issue itself.
People were upset, right?
Yeah. I think, the arts community was kind of confused and upset because—
And caught off balance too, I can only imagine.
Yeah. Our city, has a thriving arts community and any city with that kind of robust community would want to understand, cuts like that and want to be able to advance the arts, continue to support the arts. And that's, Arts KC, we want to continue to be that community partner for the arts, for the city, for the mayor. And so our job was to try to figure out how we could bring all parties together to come to some conclusions.
Well, it sounds like you did that because a lot of you showed up at City Hall in the days that followed. What did you guys do?
So for us, we just put the materials in the artists and the arts organizations' hands and let them speak for themselves. We think, their involvement is far more impactful than anything that we could do ourselves. And I think they were already geared up to have that voice. And I think we've seen that at all of the budget hearings. They've been robustly attended, and they have been the speakers have been very eloquent. And I think they've really made some inroads. So kudos to them.
I was going to say, folks rallied. They showed up at City Hall. They made their point and their feelings known here. So the mayor then backed off some of those cuts. How are you feeling about where things stand today?
Yeah, so I think it's, you know, it's important for us to for the community to understand exactly what's at stake and what's been proposed. So the $200,000 that's been proposed to go to Visit KC, you know, it sounds on its surface like, oh, they got $25,000 more.
And this is to the Film Commission.
Right, to the Film Commission, the Film Office. But really, it's a redirecting of funds that go to Visit KC to say you need to allocate $200,000 of your funds to the Film Office itself. So it's not an additional $200,000 from the city directly to the Film Office. So we want to make that very clear. And then as far as Arts Tech goes,
again, just to be real clear with the Film Commission, the cut has been restored. And is there $25,000 in additional dollars going?
No, so the cut has not been restored in the sense of city money going to the Film Commission. The cut's been restored as far as saying, you Visit KC, the funds that you have, you need to divert $200,000 to the Film Commission. So it would be kind of like me telling you, here's $100, you need to spend $40 of this on groceries and $60 needs to be spent on, you know, whatever.
Right.
So it's not, I didn't give you $60 more dollars for the additional stuff. I gave you $100 and told you how to allocate $60.
Right. And so how do you feel about that?
I mean, so it's not up for us to have a feeling. It's up for us to advocate for the arts in general. So I think we're trying to help the Film Office tell their story and show the good work of them. I mean, since their inception just around 5 years ago, they've had that $75,000 credit that that does not get rolled over. If they don't use it, they don't use it every year. Whatever they don't use goes back into the city. And they've produced $51 million in economic impact for our region and untold counts for promotion of the area. With Queer Eye as one example, I was talking to someone in the staff yesterday.
Huge hit of a TV show.
Absolutely.
That came to Kansas City, obviously.
600 million hits on just the internet, and that is not including the streams on Netflix. That's not including anyone watching it. It's just hits of the television show in this city. 600 million. For a $75,000 investment, that's kind of promotion you can't buy. So
then there was American Ninja Warrior, right?
Yeah.
In front of Union Station, if I recall correctly.
Correct, yeah. And that was some years ago now. But there's a lot of money and promotion there. And us as Arts KC, we just got back from Jeff City yesterday trying to talk to our state legislature about the film tax incentive for our entire state. So it's a little difficult to go to the state and say we should be promoting this because there's millions of dollars that are being funneled, particularly to Georgia from Missouri, because we don't have the reinstatement of our film tax credit when our own municipality is giving restriction to that and potentially cutting it. So we're just here to say this is an investment. This is a wealth of return on investment that is kind of just being left by the wayside if we don't, you know, actively use it.
We're talking about arts funding in Kansas City. The mayor has made some cuts and he's restored some of them. We're trying to sort out where things stand today. You know, one of the big hurdles, it seems to me, Brandon, for arts funding right now is this idea that, you know, that Kansas City can't get a handle on its violent crime problem. So why is there any argument for arts funding when that reality continues to stare us in the face? I mean, there's also free bus service. That's a big issue for a lot of folks, or more affordable housing. Mm-hmm. So how does the arts make a case against a backdrop like that?
Sure. I mean, I think not unlike our peer cities like Nashville, San Antonio, and others, they struggle with similar issues, right? And we see that the cities that have implemented arts programs have donated or have invested in that particular sector and then utilized it as in partner relationships have curbed a lot of these issues. I mean, we see from the Americans for the Arts, communities where there are arts presence have 18% less serious crime and 14% fewer reports of abuse and neglect. And that is something that the catalytic power of the arts, when given the opportunity to grow in an area, can affect change. And we know that it is more efficient, it's less costly, and it's more sustainable and longer lasting because the community has a vested interest in it. There's an amazing article in The Atlantic that I would ask all of your viewers to find that talks specifically about areas like the Bronx and New Orleans and how they were able to curb a lot of their violent crime through the power of the arts, through performance, through dance. It's The Atlantic disrupting the cycle of urban violence with arts and culture. And I think that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about using partnerships, public-private partnerships between the city, the arts community, and arts organizations like Arts KC to help bridge all these gaps between the communities and really produce some positive results for our city. And the office, you know, an office, dedicated office in City Hall is really the housing agent that can help fulfill all of that. So that's why we're such big proponents of an office in City Hall. We're not, you know, we have talked to the mayor and we have encouraged him to view the office in a way that makes sense for him, his agenda, his priorities. But we think that utilizing the office, harnessing the office, which is infrastructure we've worked a long time to build up, can achieve great things if he will just use it and not scrap it. And that's what we ask.
This is the Office of Creative and Cultural Services you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If our listeners want to join our conversation, we're talking about the value of arts in a community like Kansas City. And is there a place for city arts funding at a time when the homicide rate is what it is, that free bus service remains an important priority, also affordable housing? Our number, 816-235-2888, is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, let's go back to that Office of Creative and Cultural Services. The mayor, is calling for the elimination of it. What is that office?
Yeah, so this was an office formed with the...
Under Sly James, right?
Yeah, under the cultural plan, the regional cultural plan. And it distributes the funds for this KC Film Office for Arts Tech and other programs. So, but more than that, what it really is it ensures that the arts have a voice in City Hall. They have a seat at the table, like the great musical Hamilton that we've all been obsessed with. You know, there's someone who's in the room where it's happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that they can, that office can help be the conduit from the arts community to City Hall and from City Hall to the arts community. And what that can really do at its most impactful and its most efficient is give the mayor, the city council, the tools of the arts community to initiate creative approaches to these issues that are plaguing our city and that the mayor has said that is a priority to him. So Arts KC, we want to be that partner. We want to be helpful. We want to see the mayor succeed as we've done for years under many administrations and here in the city.
You know, funding for that program, for that office, Brandon, and you know this better than I, had grown from $200,000 roughly in 2015 to $540,000 this last year. That's quite a big jump. Why the increase?
I couldn't speak to that as far as, you know, the ins and outs of that funding increase. But I will say that I think it's from various programmatic offerings and funding to their programs like the Film Office and Arts Tech. I think it's grown out of a need and a seen return investment. We know that in the city alone, we have every year $244+ million in economic activity produced by the arts, and the office of and this office has been the housing agent, the catalytic agent for that progression. And so we're trying to maintain that kind of representation so that the impact can continue to be felt in this area.
It's sort of the foundation for the arts in the community, at least at City Hall, is what you're describing it as.
Yeah. It's a municipal tool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Tom from Kansas City, Missouri. Tom, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about city arts funding. Good morning.
Hi, just a short comment. I have a lot of property just east of Truce that we've been restoring and holding on to for last few years, and the number one driving force of development in the neighborhood coming this way is the arts. And frankly, when they come in and improve neighborhoods, the crime also gets mm-hmm. cleaned up. So we need more arts funding more than we need more ineffective police funding.
That's interesting. Tom, I appreciate that.
Yeah, to Tom's point, we know that communities where art is present, communities where artists grow, they not only do they return back to their community, the investment in them, but we see a 20% rise in property values. And I think that is something that particularly, like Tom was saying, east of Troost and other communities that are seeing revitalization right now, that's something that is a vested interest for them, mm-hmm. is that property value rise. And that's by something that can be as simple as, you know, cleaning up a park, painting, you know, over dilapidated structures. It creates a sense of community and an investment that we can see turns into dollars in everyone's pockets.
Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on Up to Date with Brandon Harrelson. He's with Arts KC. Good morning.
Brandon, doesn't your organization have information to put out that shows how many jobs are created by arts? I will take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Frank.
We have, yes, on our website, artskc.org, we have the AEP5, Arts and Economic Prosperity Study, that was done in 2015. And it does show that in our region, the arts are our third largest employer with over 9,000 employees. So it's HCA Midwest and Cerner and the arts. If all, and that is, I should say, make the point of, that is just nonprofit arts and culture entities. That is not including the Sprint Center. And it's with a third of our local nonprofit arts and cultural entities reporting. So
does that mean that we lose all those 9,000 jobs if the city cuts arts funding?
I think it's hard to tell. I don't want to be hyperbolic and say that, you know, we'll lose our right. third largest employer or anything like that. But the real answer is that we just don't know. I mean, we don't know what the kind of ripple effect of this funding could be. You know, immediately it would cost a couple of people some jobs just from the office and from others. But really what we're more concerned about at Arts KC is the community impact of these cuts, what that could mean to our greater region and prosperity.
You know, how does Kansas City's public support for the arts, you know, Brandon, compare, I'm talking about taxpayer dollars here, compared to other cities around the country? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of similar cities, like I said before, even Philadelphia being an example, San Antonio and Nashville. The arts, we know, in Kansas City are a huge are of huge importance to the citizens here, mm-hmm. and they see it. We think of the cities as our sports teams, barbecue, probably reverses to barbecue, sports teams, and the arts. And they're a close top three. You know, it's they're of equal importance to almost everyone in the area. And, you know, I mean, anecdotally, even people, you know, I'm from Southwest Missouri. That's why I say Missouri. So, but my family, so forgive me. You know, my family is very conservative. I was raised in a kind of country home. And in that rural community, the impact of the arts is even seen there. And in talking about these discussions with my family, their first response was about the economic impact, was about, you know, the growth that a city sees when its cultural institutions are not only revitalized, which I think we've already done, but are held up and mm-hmm. and uplifted.
Charles from Shawnee. Charles, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Yes, sir. How are you?
Well, thanks.
My comment is, I believe that, or my impression, that schools, education systems have been not funding the arts programs in schools. Wondered if the expert there has any comment on that.
How about arts funding for schools, Brandon? Any thoughts?
I think we have seen that schools have cut their arts funding many of the communities in the region, but that's, you know, that's unfortunately a tale that's been told for a very long time. It seems like the arts are kind of the first on the chopping block,
right?
When it comes to schools, and it's really unfortunate when we have schools in the area like the Academy for Integrated Arts that are using arts every day in the classroom to teach every manner of subject, and it is so successful, mm-hmm. not only as far as charter schools go, and you know, we all have feelings about that, but they have shown that it's increased their test scores, which is so important for everyone nowadays, and that the kids are so much more committed and they're more successful in their academics.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. That's Brandon Harrelson. He's the Communications Manager for Engagement and Public Policy for Arts KC. Brandon, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah.
Tomorrow on the show, the leader of KC Mothers in Charge will tell us about a new door-to-door campaign called Why Are We So Angry? Yesterday in the show, we tested the theory that love conquers all when it comes to dating someone with different political views. You can hear that and other conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. Thank you.